Hey everybody, welcome back to 10% True. Just before you get stuck into this episode, I wanted to let you know that in 2024, I'm going to be republishing my book, Red Eagles, America's Secret MiGs. That's the story of the 4477th Test and Evaluation Squadron and the program Constant Peg that exposed American fighter air crew to secretly acquired and operated MiGs in the Nevada desert in the 1970s and 1980s. The book's been out of print for a while. It goes for crazy prices online, but I'll be republishing as a softback exclusively through my website, 10percenttrue.com. If you're thinking about supporting the channel, you'd like to buy the book for yourself or even as a gift, please do go and place a pre-order. I'll put a link in the description. All pre-orders are going to be 25% off, and I'll make sure I personally inscribe and sign your copy for you. Anyway, I'll let you get back on with enjoying this episode. Take care. Here we go. Okay, we're going live.
Okay, so
okay, we're live now. I'm just going to wait. So let's just give it a couple of minutes for somebody to join. Got no viewers.
Well, of course they have to re-enter.
That's not the point. They should have been waiting.
But I mean, I tried to come in, and all I got was the old thing. So maybe I should bring it up, and I'll be waiting, and you can have your first.
Well, I don't know. Maybe we've got some people now. Can anybody hear us? And by us, I mean, can anybody hear Star Baby?
Yeah, so I guess I need to keep talking rather continuously.
Like Al, is that? That's not you. Wait a minute.
But, I mean, I tried to come in, and all I got was the old... All right, I can hear me.
Okay, have you got... have you got anything playing audio in your end? Is your audio quiet apart from your mic?
It is now. Okay. I just pulled up Safari. I checked our live stream. I could hear me on a slight delay. So we're up.
All right. Win. Okay. So everybody, I'm really sorry about that. I don't know what to say. The software I use, I haven't touched it since we last did this, and this is the only thing I ever use it for, so I don't know why it broke, but clearly it did, and I apologize. Apparently, I've got a bad echo now. Gosh, you couldn't make it up, could you?
Why? I do not hear an echo.
You don't hear an echo? No, so it's something in the setup, so just a second.
Well, you'd think we suck at this.
Wait a minute. All right. Has that fixed it? Do I still have a bad echo? Can anybody tell me if I still have a bad echo? Yeah, and so we did have a playback of the stream, and that's been turned off, so thanks for letting us know about that. Randy, have I still got an echo, or am I good? Yes, I still have an echo. Fixed. Win. Fuck. Okay, wait a minute.
Come on. Maybe you should step away and refill that wine glass.
I need the bottle. That's what I need. Okay. All right. Thank you, everybody. Thank you so much for bearing with us and me in particular. I appreciate that. And I'm now out of focus, but that's the last of my worries. Okay. So, Star Baby, as I was saying, what's going on now? As I was saying before, so everybody heard the question, but nobody heard the answer. So the question was, if anybody happens to be joining this who didn't hear the buffoonery first time around, the question was from somebody, is this basically Ukrainian, pro-Ukrainian propaganda, and why should anybody be interested in anything you've got to say when you clearly are sort of signaling your support for Ukraine as a participant in this conflict?
Right. So during the interim, I took the opportunity to actually pull up on another screen the definition of propaganda, which says information, especially of a biased or misleading nature, used to promote or publicize a particular political cause or point of view. So I would not have thought this was propaganda. I'm clearly showing where my sympathies lie. But if anybody thinks I'm bullshitting them, then call me on it. And we can have that discussion, and you're going to lose. So there we go. Turn your radars off and go home.
Well, that's a brilliant segue. So, and from my point of view, clearly, if I thought that this was just unadulterated propaganda and was there to serve the purposes only of sort of supporting one viewpoint, then I wouldn't be doing it. So, but that's a great segue, because the second thing that I heard this week that was very egregious was that you can identify me by the fact I wear t-shirts from concerts that took place before I was born. It was very rude. But arsehole said that. So I wore a different t-shirt today.
There we go.
So I know everybody at home is thinking, that is an amazing t-shirt. Well, it is. And what's more, it could be yours. Well, as many of them as you want could be yours. So you can go to the 10%true.com website and buy that. All right. We've had all these shenanigans. I've talked too much. Stubby, why don't you give us a quick rundown then of where we're at in the Ukraine conflict, what we've seen. So I think November was the last time we did this. And for anybody who's new to this or is listening at home, the way we're going to work this is Starbaby's going to give us a quick summary of how he sees things. I've got a couple of questions I'd like to ask him from my point of view. We'll do a quick interlude where I just thank people fundamentally, and then we'll go to the AMA. So you'll have your opportunity to ask Starbaby any Ukraine or even non-Ukraine relevant questions. So I'll let you talk.
So quick and dirty, in December, I expected Ukraine to start a counteroffensive when the ground froze, and the ground did not freeze, particularly in the south, Zaporizhia and Kherson Oblast. The ground did not freeze. It passed the freeze date. It didn't freeze. It was all still muddy. And only a lunatic goes on the offense when you're dealing with muddy ground. It's called General Mud for a reason, and it defeats people. It defeated Hitler. It defeated Napoleon. It's busy defeating the Russians right now. But the Ukrainians, having not been able to go on the offensive, which I might add, this could be the first mechanized offensive ever forestalled by climate change, they decided to change the terms of the conversation. And the terms of the conversation stopped where they never said, well, we can't go on the offensive because it's too damn warm. They said, we can't go on the offensive because the Germans haven't given us enough tanks. Completely, you know, bypassing the fact that they had just executed two successful offensive, one in Kharkiv and one in Kherson, without a single German tank in the inventory. Now, all of a sudden, it's the Germans. So their ground offensive turned into a diplomatic offensive, and it worked like a champ. And then the Russians apparently, the chief of the general staff, General Gerasimov, got the worst job in the universe. It's like, okay, take command of the Russian forces. And he's the chief of staff. He's not a ground commander. That is not a combat position, but he gets a combat position. He gets the worst job in the Russian military for a general officer, which is try and save all this, so that, you know, you won't accidentally fall out a window or something like that. And so he's been avoiding windows for months. And apparently, according to Ukrainian intelligence, he was under pressure to recapture all of the Donbas, which is Luhansk and Donetsk oblasts, by the end of March. And it's the muddy season. So a little over a month ago, the Russians go on the offensive, and there's a big split in among the observers. You know, one side of the split among the Western ones is going, oh my God, the Russians are on offensive. They have all 200,000 people. It's going to suck. And then you have the other half saying the Russians don't have the forces, the supplies, the logistical infrastructure, the ammunition, or the training to effectively sustain a big offensive. And leading this charge was the Institute for Study of War, Washington, D.C. Do great job. It's there at understandingwar.org. And they do a daily update on Ukraine. And they said from the get-go that when the Russians go on the offensive, they're not going to have the forces to do it. They were late in calling it. There was actually an Austrian analyst named Tom, who was the first that I saw to call it when the Russians went on the offensive. And it has largely been static. There have been some minor Russian gains in Luhansk, but they're like this far from the border of Luhansk Oblast, and they can't get to it because the Ukrainian defense has been tough. They're on the ridge lines. They have a river to aid them. So the Oskol River is part of their defensive line. And then the Russians focused on Bakhmut, and the press focused on Bakhmut. And it's like, Bakhmut is this strategic city, and everything's on Bakhmut. Well, the Ukrainians are fighting hard to keep it. And a lot of people have been working hard. A lot of people have been getting hurt. A lot of Ukrainians have been getting killed. to hold Bakhmut, but it's not stupid. It was a brilliant strategy to bleed the Russians in front of a fortified position that the Ukrainians could, at the end of the day, afford to lose. So the Russian capture of Bakhmut gets them nothing, but maybe a victory parade, meaning nothing, because it just moves them over a teeny tiny little river that is better named a creek in many places. And now they have to go against a couple other Ukrainian cities that have had months to fortify. So it had no significance, no rail junctions, no roads leading north, south, east, and west. I mean, all roads may lead to Rome, but all roads do not lead out of Bakhmut. And so the Ukrainians, I think, proved how good they are at operational art and better at the American naysayers who were saying, oh my God, you're spending all these forces defending Bakhmut. Well, they were going to have to defend somewhere, right? So why not defend in an urban area where you've got good positions and you've had months after months to prepare? So what it looks like now, today, is that the Russians operationally encircled Bakhmut, and it didn't matter. Operational encircled doesn't mean you get all the way around. It means that theoretically that you have enough of a surround, like kind of a crab reaching around your city, that you can prevent people from going back and forth into the city and resupplying it. But that didn't happen. The Ukrainians kept the lines open. And so the Russians are sitting there on both flanks and advancing and losing ridiculous amounts of forces. The Wagner military group, private military company, the mercenaries, has been completely blasted. The Wagner Air Force has largely been shot down. And it's the territorial guard and reserve forces and border police that have been holding the line in Bakhmut. And it's been a brilliant move. In the south, there was a Russian offensive involving naval infantry brigades. That went nowhere in the town around the town of Vuhledar. And Vuhledar is nothing. It is a nowhere town that just has a bunch of apartment blocks and some suburbs. And a division equivalent went after that town, and the Ukrainians slaughtered them. And it was two battalions of mechanized infantry with a battalion in reserve holding the city. So they're outnumbered at least 4-1. Except that they happen to have an armor brigade backing them up. So when the Russians went around the flanks, looked like they gained some position. And the next thing you know, the armored brigade shows up, ruins the Russian day, smashes the forces, and you're back to square one. So also over the winter, the Russians engaged in a blatantly illegal extended war crime targeting energy infrastructure and civilian targets in the intent of freezing the Ukrainians out. Well, it turned out to be a warm winter, as we've previously addressed, and the Ukrainians stuck it out. They were in no danger of surrendering. It just hardened their resolve. And eventually they got to the point where they were so good at repairing their own electrical infrastructure that blackouts became minor to non-existent. And now more lights are coming on all over the country. So good help from the West, smart use of their resources in Ukraine, and a complete failure of an air campaign, and the Russians shot themselves dry. They appear to be out of Iskander ballistic missiles. They're low on cruise missiles of all types, although they can produce those at some 30 per month. They shot dry themselves dry on their Iranian Shahed drones. You know, they got a batch of 500 to 700, and they shot most of those, and now they're bringing in more. So there were two air raids this week, one with 11 Shaheds and one with 16 Shaheds. And typically about 70% of those get shot down. And, you know, of note to aviation enthusiasts, the first MiG-29s officially arrived from Western supply. And I believe they're Slovaks MiG-29s, but they arrived. Although the Poles appear to have provided MiG-29s earlier, a pair of them, that kind of trickled out, but they provided them as spare parts. It just so happens that the way they packaged their spare parts was in a complete airplane that they flew into Ukraine at some point. But they said, no, we just shipped them spare parts. Just two copies of everything conveniently assembled in an easily transportable package. And now, as you look at Ukraine and Russia, Russians just got their butts kicked, and their forces are depleted again. Reconstituted units have been shattered. The Russians are bringing T-54 tanks out of storage. T-54 started production in 1949. And they are not modern tanks. I mean, don't get me wrong, they're still tanks. And as an infantryman, you would hate to deal with a tank, unless you happen to have a javelin, and then, you know, it's Katie bar the door, right? And like any other Russian tank, the ammunition is volatile and unprotected. So you get a penetration inside the turret, and the whole turret blows off and, you know, tries to reach the moon. So that's kind of the big picture. Western resolve has not cracked. The Western training going on in the UK and the US and other NATO partners. I can't remember which of the Baltic republics has a neat little program whereby their way for dealing with drunk drivers is to seize their car. And so they can save on storage fees, they've been shipping them to Ukraine and donating them. So if you're in one of the Baltic republics, you drink and drive, they're going to seize your car and it's going to end up in Ukraine. So I don't even think you can take the tax deduction at that stage of the game. And so that big picture is where we are, waiting for the end of the muddy season to see what happens. And the Ukrainians are saying publicly that they're going to go on a counteroffensive in the Donbas. And I'm not going to try and forecast their moves. But you have to say to yourself, if the Ukrainians are saying we're going to go on the offensive here, they've never telegraphed a move before, and they're probably not starting now. So there we go.
Unless it's a double bluff.
It could be, but either way, you know, it's a great move. The problem with the Donbas, Luhansk and Donetsk Oblast, is that they have been so heavily fought over that they are heavily fortified. There's trenches everywhere. Literally, you've been fighting there since 2014. There might be easier places to start a fight.
So I appreciate that it's difficult not being there on the ground to talk in any detail about this, but it's noteworthy that since the early days of the conflict, the sort of stream of videos that was coming in and contributing to the OSINT picture has stopped, and I sort of understand that. That's a fairly predictable thing to happen. But what do you think is happening to the combat air forces on each side of this particular conflict then? You know, there was, when we talked back in November, which I think was the last stream we did, they were using the long range, you called it asshole. But the AXE, I can't remember the NATO code name for it, but it was the very long range air to air missile. They appeared to be having some success with that, the Russians, that is, in downing Ukrainian aircraft. You would imagine that the Ukrainian supplies of airframes are dwindling. I don't know where they are on the spares side of things. I don't know how their logistics works. I don't know how much of an impact the two aircraft from Poland and the four from Slovakia are going to have. But what is happening, do you think, between the two air forces on each side, you know, within the constraints of what you've already talked about in terms of doctrinally, you know, the sort of aerial artillery effect that the Russians have for their VKS forces?
So the Ukrainian strikes using refitted target drones against Engels Air Base in Russia forced the bombers to relocate farther east. But they can still launch air-launched cruise missiles from out of the range of any Ukrainian asset. And so the Russians might or might not be still doing their combat air patrols. I haven't been paying attention to it. And they're definitely launching missiles from well outside Ukrainian air defense envelopes in a targeting scheme where they're pretty much wasting those missiles, although they are obviously breaking things and killing people, nothing that will have an effect on the outcome of the war. Both sides have lost aircraft and air crew. I know in the intervening 3 months that one Ukrainian MiG-29 pilot was lost, and one of their top Su-25 Frogfoot pilots was lost on a combat mission because he took a hit, and he was near a Ukrainian town when he took the hit at low altitude, couldn't trade away to get some altitude, stayed with the airplane so that it wouldn't come down in the civilian area. And then was killed in action. And so also Wagner's air force, such as it is, focused around Bakhmut, has taken some pretty serious damage. And those aircraft have been shot down. So the Russians have lost more over the 3-month time period, but they have more to lose. And the Ukrainians are still shooting HARMS, and they are getting new weapons in country, especially the JDAM-ER, the JDAM with wings, 500 pounder. And we'll see what they can do with that. But I think that Ukraine has largely been husbanding their resources, and they have been flying ground attack. But since they're not on the offense, I suspect it's just like any other high value Ukrainian asset. Is they're being held in reserve for when they're really needed.
Let me ask you a little bit about that then. I mean, there are multiple strands to the conversation. The most obvious one that has been in the media this week and has never really gone away is the request for F-16s. And, you know, you're constantly hearing this narrative that you can get an F-16 pilot out of a training pipeline in 6 months. And we've talked before about that not being the equivalent to getting somebody who can go and then, you know, fight within 6 months. Those are different things. And you're effectively setting up a lamb to the slaughter if you think that's the case. But one of the things that I talked to somebody about recently who has, I think, some knowledge of this is the exchanges with the Fresno Air National Guard. So the F-15 guys from Fresno have been over, I think it's Fresno, have been over to Ukraine in, you know, the last sort of 10 years, a few times. They've done an exchange. And one of the things that I'd heard that was an outcome of that was that while it was a useful thing to do, to build relations and to try and impart some knowledge to the Ukrainian guys, was that fundamentally they still employ a Soviet Air Force mindset. They still have sort of a set of tactics where perhaps they don't have a foreship where the flight lead is in a position to make decisions about what they're going to do and be dynamic. You know, they're still working to a set of tactics that perhaps they've learned by rote, and they're going to go and execute on that rather than think dynamically and perhaps have a more of a Western mindset. And that's not a criticism. That's just what I've heard. I don't know if that's true. But what the question that I'm getting to is, do you think that with the arrival of HARM, with the arrival of JDAM, with the discussion and the constant pushing for F-16s, and with the experiences that these guys are having on a daily basis fighting the Russians, that they are likely pivoting more towards a Western mindset? Or do you think that they are constrained by the technology that they don't have access to continue operating the aeroplane in a more simple and simplified manner?
The answer is both. And the reason the answer is both is because the Ukrainians started really shifting by 2015. They were already trying to shift towards a Western mindset because the Soviet mindset and their older officers, that was not working for them. And we saw it when the Russians invaded the second time last year. We saw the Ukrainians capable of small unit, distributed, independent actions that would not have been possible under a Soviet model. So we know for the ground forces that Ukraine made a major pivot. What I've heard, and I've never flown with, you know, the Ukrainians on any exercise, what I've heard is that they were also starting the shift. And what they were using the NATO and U.S. exercises for was to do that tactical shift. But the reality of flying a MiG-29 or a Su-27 is that those aircraft were designed to fight a certain way under a certain level of command and control. And so things like the pilot vehicle interface, et cetera, is designed so that you get placed in a piece of the airspace and the pilot flies there, and then the weapon systems do their thing to get you a targeting solution that has largely been predetermined from the ground. That's what it's designed to do. So while the MiG-29s, Su-27s have a radar, and it's not like an APG in a Western fighter, it's not like an older radar. The American Western radar philosophy is that they are sensors, and the Soviet philosophy was that their radars are an airborne extension of a ground-directed fire control system. So that's a different approach, and you're just handicapped by the hardware. There are things I could not do in the F-4 that I could do in the F-15E that were entirely dependent on the radar and the way the radar information was displayed, and that's a handicap. In terms of getting to the F-16, for example, There's no question that the Ukrainian pilots can transition and do it relatively quickly into safely flying an F-16 around. Flying the F-16 is not the same as employing the F-16. And I don't want to rehash the article, but I wrote an article called Amateur Hour Part 3. It's still not about the airplane. And I lay it out. And the short version of this is it takes 3 to 6 months to train you to fly the F-16, at which you're a wingman and which you are not really ready for combat. And when the U.S. Air Force got F-16s, when they arrived, they showed up at Hill Air Force Base and they had experienced aircrew and experienced maintainers who were familiar with the tools, the logistics systems, the tactics, the training methods. They were familiar with all of that. And it took them more than a year to reach what we call IOC, or initial operational capability. That's not a good metric. And the metric I use is, when do you graduate your first weapons school instructor? That's when you're up to speed and you're really ready to go to war with the capability. That took 4.5 years after the first airplanes arrived at Hill. And so if the U.S. Air Force, that is just transitioning aircraft and not transitioning logistics systems, maintenance, training, and they have a Vietnam experienced bunch of guys, takes 4.5 years to really get to that kind of warfighting skill level, it's unreasonable to expect Ukraine, no matter how good their pilots are, to jump in an F-16 and as if you suddenly get the air power capability. It's just an airplane.
Okay, so as a follow-on question to that then, if you take the long-term view of war, and, you know, they've been fighting the Russians since 2014, the invasion of Crimea, but not to the same way that they are now. But if you take the long-term view of war, we're now, what are we, 15 months in? No, we're 13 months in. 13 months in since the invasion. If 6 months in, the Ukrainians had sent some people to the US to start training, would that be giving them more of a chance than if they decide in 6 months' time that actually it's okay to start sending some people over to get trained on the F-16, and then maybe they spend 18 months in the US? I mean, I'd imagine that's inconceivable. I'd imagine as soon as they're ready, they'd bring them back. But what I'm thinking is just, you know, the scenarios. If you had somebody who'd started that journey a year ago or 6 months ago, would that be, do you think, likely to make a material difference to, let's say, the offensive that Ukraine is talking about going on later in the year?
No. That would have moved your 4.5 year time frame, and you would have started it already. So you'd still have 3 years and 9 months to go if you started it 9 months ago, right? You're still stuck there. And I went through, I mean, I transitioned from the F-4, 1,000 hours in the F-4, transitioned the F-15E. And when you look at red flag, so red flag is a big exercise out at Nellis Air Force Base, in which you are flying a whole bunch of airplanes against defended airspace with red air, adversary air. And that was created in part to give fighter aviators experience that they couldn't get any other way, as if it were simulated combat, because we realized, the Air Force realized coming out of Vietnam, that the majority of aviators that were lost over Vietnam were lost in their first 10 combat missions. If you survived your first 10 and all those mistakes, your chances of surviving your 100 mission tour were much higher. Red Flag is designed to get you through all those stupid mistakes you're going to make on your first 10 missions. And I think it does that. But I will tell you that I flew a lot of Red Flags at Nellis, because I was stationed at Nellis flying F-4Gs. And if I was home and there was a red flag, there were weasels flying in it. And I was on the schedule and I was going to fly in them. So I flew in flag after flag after flag after flag. And I transitioned to the F-15E and I went to a flag. And on the third sortie, Norm and I got killed because we had a new set of stupid mistakes to learn, because the aircraft was so much better that we thought we could do things that we could not do. So we're talking 2,000-hour guys, you know, making a mistake that gets us killed, which is turn back into an air-to-air fight because somebody called for help with no situational awareness, and eat a couple simulated air-to-air missiles as soon as you complete the turn. dumb, 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 dumb. And, but I had to make that mistake in a new airplane before it sunk in. And I should have known better, but there's a whole bunch of, you know, people who were placed underground prematurely because they should have known better. So Ukrainians are good. I mean, they're probably starting from an above average standpoint in terms of aviator skills, and they've certainly got the motivation. They're defending their country, but there is no air power, just add water kind of solution. You've got to build it, and it takes time. And when I came out of the strike Eagle FTU with, you know, 60 hours or whatever and arrived at Lakenheath, I was not the aviator that I would be 300 hours later when I was considered experienced. And I was not the aviator at 300 hours in the strike Eagle that I was at 600 hours in the strike Eagle. By 600 hours in the strike Eagle, I was a stud. And I've got the tapes to prove it.
Do you, are you of the view then broadly that this conflict will likely end ahead of any viable option then to equip Ukraine with anything and to get its pilots trained to the level they would need to be trained at to materially impact the outcome of the war?
So no, because I'm going to parse that question when you say equipped with anything. So I think that the F-16 training and provision of F-16s and the maintenance, all that should have started 6 months ago. It should have started 6 months ago. But it is a future Ukraine problem against a future Russia. If you want a capability that Ukrainian can use now and would affect the conduct of the war now, it's a TACMS or another long-range missile strike system that is just a variation on the Gimlers that they're already shooting out of HIMARS and M270 launchers that would give them the range to strike targets deep enough to do a deeper interdiction effort than they already are. And that might mean hitting the Kerch Bridge again. Although the warhead on an ATACMS is not going to be great against the Kerch Bridge, it may not drop spans. It's going to put holes in the deck. And the Ukrainians have proven that you put enough holes in the deck, you don't have a deck. You don't have a deck. You don't have a bridge. It doesn't matter whether the girders are holding it up. You know, it's like you've got girders holding up a slice of Swiss cheese, the kind with the big holes in it, and you're trying to roll a marble down it. It's not going to work.
How does that fit then with reports that are coming in around munition stocks? So Western countries and United States in particular, I suppose, because they've been the supplier of many of these munitions, have their own supplies to maintain, their own stockpiles to maintain. China is a concern. You know, that could, you know, 2027 is the magic date, isn't it, that everybody's talking about, but that could kick off conceivably at any time. You have to make sure that your cupboards aren't threadbare. Is there a balance? Well, there is, but what is the balance then between air power delivering a precision strike capability against those kinds of targets and using ground-based assets like ATACMS?
Well, we're in pretty good shape on the air power munitions, but I think that the war in Ukraine has demonstrated you're going to end up using munitions much more quickly than you expected to. So that's always a danger. And in the U.S., and really in NATO countries, munitions have been a bill payer. If your budget ran short, you just ran the munition production down to the minimum possible level to keep the production line open. You used it to pay your other bills. And that was, people have been calling that out as short-sighted for more than 10 years, because I only heard it first when I pinned on Colonel in 2011. And one of the initial problems was we're not buying enough munitions and this, that, and the other thing. And we do not have the production capacity. So production capacity is ramping up. But there were reports this week that there are shortages of gun cotton and the plastic explosives the plastic-based explosives that are largely insensitive munitions, even TNT. All this stuff is in low supply in Europe because the industrial base to produce in quantity doesn't exist. So that's a tough problem. We're probably in better shape with JDAMs because it's just Mark 82, 83, 84 bomb bodies. And those production lines go pretty well. But the Ukrainians just don't have the capacity. They do not have the capacity to deplete us on air-delivered munitions in the same way that if you're firing 5,000 shells a day, that depletes munition stockpiles. And the Russians are firing 20,000 shots per day, and those are way down. Those are a third to a quarter of what they were this time last year, because of the stockpile problems. So that is one of the big lessons, is part of your warfighting capability is your industrial base, and you've got to be able to produce ammunition. And so the U.S. found the same thing in Iraq and Afghanistan, except that it was small arms ammunition. Had to upgrade the production. And now, which is another reason why we should not have been caught aware on the 155 millimeter artillery shells and so on. But ATACMS is supposed to be replaced by PrSM, and that program is underway. And I think just supplying a couple of hundred would be great, because if we don't supply them and we don't shoot them, we're going to have to pay money to demilitarize them, and that's expensive. So just let the Ukrainians use their rapid demilitarization program and we're good to go.
Let me ask you, I'm not sure how far we are in time-wise, but let me ask you just a quick question then around the recent MQ-9 event out there in the Black Sea and the Su-27 hitting it, is what it looks like. I did watch this week a video from the West Coast Aerospace Forum 2022, and I know that you're a little cynical about these four-star generals standing up on a podium and talking about various things, but it was interesting to listen to one of the generals talk about lessons learned and the experiences that they had had so far in observing Russian behavior. And he had talked about how in the run-up to February of 2022 and the invasion, he had been working with various NATO countries to make sure that there were combat air patrols airborne at all times to protect NATO airspace. They kind of knew the Russians, even though the Russians and even China were saying it's not going to happen. They had sort of made the presupposition that it would happen. So they were sort of corralling the troops and making sure that happened. And one of the things that he said that was interesting was that they put two MQ-9 sort of ISR caps, I don't know what they're called, ISR orbits or something, right there, sort of 14, 15 miles off the coast. In the Black Sea, and he said it really pissed the Russians off, and the Russians were sending these messages saying, if you don't move them, we will shoot them down. And I guess then the political powers that be decided that they would move them. The military guys, I think, said, no, we're in international airspace, we have every right to be there, we'll do it. So I suppose the question I have then around the recent shoot down was whether or not that is a symptom of frustration boiling over, or is that actually a modus operandi of the the Russian generals or Vladimir Putin or whoever, which is that if you put them there and we tell you to move them and you don't move them, you're going to lose them.
Yeah, so there's an element of all of that, but let's not rule out the sheer potential for just straight dumbassery, in which you take down a drone by accidentally hitting it. I don't think that's in anybody's plan. Although having said that, remember that the Royal Air Force used to destroy V1 buzz bombs by sticking your wing under its wing and then rolling away and flipping the thing's gyros and causing it to crash. So I can't rule out what has previously been a successful technique, but trying to match a jet fighter with an MQ-9 is a different story. Remember that the Russians used to threaten and occasionally shoot down aircraft, or the Soviets, when they were manned. And the U.S. maintained the same posture with manned aircraft. We're outside the 12-mile limit. And, sometimes the Soviets came outside the 12-mile limit and they shot some aircraft down. So this is no change. The Russians get pissed anytime you push their boundaries. And as professional historical paranoids of the 14th degree, they think everything you do is pushing their buttons.
Okay, another question then, and I'll ask one more after this, and then what we'll do is we'll do the interlude so you can have a sip of water or whatever it is that you've got.
Iced tea, man.
Iced tea, sip of iced tea. And we'll do the interlude, and then we'll get on with the AMA. So for everybody at home, I can see that Nux is helping out with some questions that are being asked, and what I'll do is I'll go through the chat and try and pick out some questions as well, and we'll use the ones from Discord. But that will be after the interlude. So two more questions then. One of the other things that was said in this this sort of presentation was the difficulty both sides are having in sort of this integrated air and missile defense challenge. So making sure, I guess, that your fighters are able to intercept, your missiles are able to intercept, and you don't rat yourself. I'm guessing that's really what they're talking about. And that's something we talked about It may be the first AMA, which was, I don't know when that was, October or you know, August or September or something like that. Can you just describe what the challenges are of setting up an integrated defense system that integrates, as the name suggests, air and ground-based assets?
So most integrated air defense systems are designed to use fighters or ground-based air defense or both. However, there are different ways to skin that cat. So you can have a fighter engagement zone and you can have a missile engagement zone. And it is best if they are separate zones, because when you mix them together, it's called a joint engagement zone. And we have been wildly unsuccessful. I got to fly in what were called the JADO-JEZ tests in the 90s, Joint Air Defense Operations, Joint Engagement Zone. And the lesson learned from that was that Patriots fratted everybody as they were coming home from their strike package. Blue Air, and both Ukraine and Russia have lost aircraft to friendly fire. So the best way to do this when you have a mix of capabilities is to separate things. So fighters do their operations at night, SAMs do it during the day, or fighters do it east of this line or above this altitude. Separate things by time, geography, altitude, but don't try and layer it. And it's still a challenge because you're still dealing with a human element. And it's one thing about air defense is it's very high speed. If you've got two ships coming to each other, they've got a combined closure speed if they're both at flank speed of 60 knots. You got two fighters coming at each other. They have a combined closure speed of, let's call it, 1,200 plus knots. Things happen fast, and half as fast if you're a ground-based air defense guy, but it's still happening fast. And so all your decision processes are compressed, and you're in a hurry, and your pulse rate's up, and you're getting the adrenaline boost, and you make errors. You know, I remind people that the Patriot has never shot down a hostile airplane, only friendly ones.
Okay. And so then as a final question, I wanted to just, it's along the similar sort of vein. So one of the observations they had was Russian targeting cycles and the way they target and their inability to do sort of anything dynamic in the air to ground sense. And again, this is something that we have covered before. You've talked about that before. And you know, these guys sort of tied back the conversation to their observations about what was happening in Syria with the Russians going and hitting Aleppo and just, you know, carpet bombing effectively a load of stuff using dumb bombs. My question then is, what would you expect? And again, within the confines of what you've said doctrinally, the VKS is used for, what their purpose is and how they're taught to operate. What would you expect senior commanders in the Russian combat air forces to be thinking around the way they operate in future? Would you expect them to be taking lessons? Would you expect them to be understanding how their soft guys work and be able to support them beyond the flot? What sort of things do you think is within their power, within their gift, to change about the way their air forces operate?
Not a damn thing. For two reasons, one of which is doctrinal, and that is that the air forces are flying artillery. That's what they're for. Okay, they're kind of expanding into cruise missile strikes, you know, which you might categorize as strategic attack from a distance. But the tactical aviation is flying artillery, and their bomber aviation is what they, you know, have always envisioned bomber aviation as, is going against deep targets, mostly civilian. The other thing is the command structure. If you're going to over centralize everything, and they do, and to be fair, so does the U.S. Air Force. But really, the Russians over-centralize everything. If you cannot allow your aviators and your tactical command and control to make independent decisions, then you're not going to get a dynamic targeting cycle, and it just doesn't matter.
It's a bit of a stupid question, but I'm going to ask it because I don't really care. Hypothetically, then, if NATO had been somehow drawn into the conflict in February 2022, for whatever reason, it doesn't really matter, but NATO now becomes involved, let's say from an air component point of view, at least. How much of a mismatch would there have been, do you think, between NATO countries operating? And bear in mind, you know, NATO works together a lot, but there are still interoperability issues. There are still capability gaps that exist between nations. But how much of an overmatch do you think there would have been for the Russian air forces, the Russian combat air forces?
I think there would have been substantial, and I think neither side would have known it at first. I think it would have been like a blind date, in that because the U.S. had overestimated Russian capabilities, that we would have taken an unnecessarily cautious approach based on capabilities that were only theoretical. Because you have to take the threat into account. You have to honor the threat. We'd have honored a threat that was greater than it was. And on the other side, the Russians, I think, don't readily conceive of the training advantage that we have, because they look at their equipment and they say, this is pretty good stuff. But even then, you're looking at inferior equipment too. So I think it would have been a very unpleasant kind of blind date experience, where both sides are bumbling to the edges of their operational parameters. And you would have found that NATO's operational parameters were wider, deeper, and higher than what the Russians could generate.
One of the things, this is my last question, I promise you, and then to the audience, thank you for your patience. We'll get to your questions. So the last question is this. So one of the observations that I've heard is that the Russians have not really engaged in as much electromagnetic warfare as maybe analysts thought they would do before the war. So there was some initial jamming. I think there was some tactical communications jamming, and actually they ended up jamming themselves a little bit. I think that put them off a bit. I've seen some videos of sort of drones dropping sort of bombs and munitions on little tactical jamming truck type things, but there hasn't been this sort of overarching EW umbrella under which everyone has operated, and there probably are some obvious reasons for that to you, but I just wondered, what do you think would explain that? Why do you think the Russians have tiptoed around that particular area of warfare?
I think they haven't. I think Russian electronic warfare has been used heavily, but because people can neither see it nor its effects, you have to infer its existence. And where I infer its existence is from Ukrainian reports of communications jamming and the threat to data links. I mean, we see YouTube videos coming out, or Telegram videos, where Ukrainian operators will say, yeah, they jammed this. I've lost 4 drones this week. All the jamming. Jamming is going on. There was a strike where the video popped up earlier today of a successful 155-millimeter Excalibur artillery strike on a Russian electronic warfare vehicle that was sitting next to a cell phone tower. So you've got this red and white cell phone tower. And I initially look at the video and I go, and it's titled Attack on Electronic Warfare System. It's like, dude, that's a cell phone tower. But it was properly labeled because the Ukrainian guys that published it started putting red circles on it. First, they circle the support building, and then they circle the teeny tiny electronic warfare van that is sitting right there. And then, of course, the film makes that electronic warfare van explode. Russians are using electronic warfare. They're using a lot of it. It has been consistently effective, but it may be tapering off just because of the number of systems lost.
Okay. All right. Let's take then a very brief interlude, which is really, as I said at the beginning, just an opportunity for me to thank a few people. So first thing I would just say is we've got 150 people who are live at the moment. If you were visiting the other video and expecting to see us, I apologize for the inconvenience in having to launch a new video. But I can see we've only got 55 likes, which either means that 2 in 3 of you thinks that Star Baby is full of shit and not worth a like, or that you just haven't got round to clicking the thumbs up yet. So if you'd like to click
the thumbs up. It's got to be the second option, because the first one can't be right.
So we've got today Nux, and he is doing the live chat. And I think we've got Mr. Assists and Sedlo. And I don't know how to say the person's name, but Hoshu, I think, is the person's name, who's been helping with some of the audio as well. So thank you to the 4 people who are sitting behind all this and helping to feed the questions through and keep things going. And also, I do have, I labor the point sometimes, but I don't do this for money. I don't make any money out of it, and it is free. And for my normal videos, there's no advertising or anything like that. But I do have a buy me a coffee function, and I'm not asking for money now, so don't send me any. But people do occasionally send me money, and I haven't thanked any of those people for many months. So if you did subscribe and like, and then go to buy me a coffee and send me some money, I'm very grateful to you. I wanted to say a particular thank you to Mike from Aircrew Interview. So Aircrew Interview, probably everybody who's listening to this is familiar with it, but Mike has a fantastic catalogue. He's been doing this a long time. Fantastic catalogue of interviews. I want to get actually him hooked up with Starbaby. I think Starbaby should go on his channel. So Mike, if you are listening to this, get in touch and I'll make the introduction. But Mike was really good when I was getting to just the point where I almost had 10,000 subscribers. He actually put a thing on his channel saying, help get me to 10,000, which did the job. It was very good. And then recently he shared one of my interviews on his channel as well. And I just think that's a stand-up move. That's quite different from some of the experiences I've had with other podcasters who actually just take my content and steal it and do what they want with it and don't attribute it to me. So he's the opposite of those people. So Mike, if you are listening, thanks very much. And then finally, before we get on to the AMAs, then I just wanted to give you a quick rundown of what's coming. So April is going to be Wild Weasel Month. As if you're not getting enough of Starbaby already, we will kick off April with the AMA that I think Starbaby and I recorded in January. I might even still have a moustache in it. I'm not sure. But we did do that AMA. It was in January, and it's just been sitting on my hard drive waiting to go out. So that will be the first thing that will go out in April. And then we have Spike. So Spike, I think his name is Benny Shack. Is that correct pronunciation?
Benny Shack, yes. Benny Shack.
So Spike is an awesome dude. He was introduced to me by Starbaby, and he has done the F4G front cockpit tour. So you can derive from that the fact he is a nose gunner. He's an F4 pilot, F4G pilot. Incidentally, he also, I think, got more hours in the T-38 than anybody else. He's got something like 6,000 hours or something in the T-38. But anyway, that's not the subject of that particular interview. That's the F4G front cockpit tour. And then later I recorded with him, and again, I think this was in February, his recollections of his time flying the F4G in Desert Storm. Can't remember exactly how many combat missions he has, but he was in there and flew for, I think, almost all of it. I think he maybe arrived a weekend, something like that, but really good guy and a great storyteller. So that will be week three. So those are all pre-recorded. Those three are in the can and they're ready to go. And then we will do, as a special treat, we will do in week four of April another AMA with Starbaby, and it will be live. So we'll run that live AMA. And any questions that you've asked that are Wild Weasel related that haven't been asked already, and there are some in the AMA for today, we'll just transfer into that live session. So book the day off, get stocked up with sandwiches, snacks, because it will be a long one to enjoy. Okay, on that note, let's go to the AMA. Let me just pull this up.
I'm going to insert two things. One, you need to thank your t-shirt designer.
Yes, I do. Yes, this is an opportunity for me to show my t-shirt off again. So this t-shirt.
Yeah, but you've also got the background.
Yes, I do, but I want to show the t-shirt. Oh, you can see my
yep, done. Yes,
okay, very good.
Jeez,
so Sci-Fi Concepts is, but I didn't want to say anything because he has rebranded and I can't remember the name. It's like Air Images or something. I don't know. I'll find out what it is. And it's Jamil. Anyway, Jamil, thank you for doing the t-shirt. Appreciate it very much.
And then the other thing is just to remind viewers that Spike Benishek is the guy that invented the supersonic sausage patty laydown.
Okay. All right. So we're just going to start from the top and then I'll just weave in some of the questions that have come in from the live stream. This is really an opportunity for you to talk about another episode that we'll do, but one of the first question was, we haven't heard anything about your time not spent at 300 knots. So any infantry stories that us aviation nerds would appreciate?
So I'm going to tell them later. The preview version of this is that I felt in 2007, I felt that in order for the Air Force to provide a better experience in terms of air power support to the ground component, that aviators needed to understand what the ground component's needs were. And that wasn't going to happen through PowerPoint briefings and reading mission reports. It was going to happen when you put an instructor aviator on the ground carrying a rifle and embedding. So if you can imagine Starbaby going through some very high-speed combat skills training with the Army Asymmetric Warfare Group, and then embedding with combat engineers, military police, and infantry in Iraq and then Afghanistan, what I will say, and the only quick preview, is the most useful phrase for the entire experience was, and I quote, there are no army officers in my chain of command. So there we go. Plenty of good stories. Mostly not aviation related. And, oh, okay, one aviation related thing. The Chinook. The CH-47 Chinook. It's a big twin rotor helicopter. It's used for troop transport. I mean, it's a marvelous vehicle from the outside. And I noticed prior to ever flying in one that whenever you saw like newsreels of soldiers getting off the back of the Chinook, they're always running. And it doesn't matter, you know, they're always running. It could be a combat zone. It could be an international airport. They could have landed accidentally in the Bahamas, you know, at a resort because they had an in-flight emergency. The Marines did that at a brothel once, by the way. But anyway, you can look it up. Look up emergency landing, helicopter, Marine, brothel, and you'll find it. And they were always running off. And I wondered, you know, why was that? Until I discovered behind the airplane is where the engines are. And the area immediately behind the helicopter is an oxygen dead zone. And it's hot. So it's bad enough flying in this thing in August or September in Baghdad because there's no ventilation. It's not like a Black Hawk where you take the doors off. You know, you're in this long tube where the only guys that have any ventilation are the gunners, and they're not sharing it with you. And this is even with the back door open. So everybody is running off the helicopter because A, it's hot, B, it's unpleasant, and C, there is no oxygen in that zone behind the helicopter. You need to clear it as soon as possible or you're going to die. There's my aviation rifle carrying story. The other trick is that if you want to sleep, you have to carry your rifle barrel down. Because if you accidentally discharge your rifle, you don't want to shoot it into the engine or the hydraulics or anything important. There's nothing important underneath you. An M4 carbine is not long enough to rest the barrel on the floor, rest your chin on the butt, and then go to sleep. But an M16 is. And I learned this because the soldier next to me, you know, I had a long rifle, a modified M16. And he says, "Can I borrow your rifle for a second?" And I said, "Sure." And I hand him my rifle and he sticks his chin on it and he goes to sleep because his M4 wasn't long enough. There we go. Aviation related rifle carrying stories.
Okay. So Norby had asked, and I think you've already answered this. You've referenced this a couple of times, but he had asked about blue on blue incidents involving the Patriot. And I think actually he talks there. He's asking about whether or not there was an F-16 CJ that fought back, and I think we've also talked about that on a previous podcast.
But we need to talk on that again because I need to thump that story like a baby.
Go on then. Do it. You answer it. Go on.
So there's a story that keeps popping up, and it is badly sourced. That a Patriot locked up during the Second Gulf War locked up friendly aircraft. That happened all the time. In fact, the Patriots shot them down occasionally, but locking them up happened routinely, and that the Patriot had engaged or was about to engage a target, an F-16 CJ guy had seen the Patriot on his system and had fired a harm on it, which, depending on who you ask, damaged the radar and shut it down. That is total, utter, and complete bullshit for two reasons. One, any fratricide or fratricide-like incident is thoroughly investigated. And the second is that the response to a blue-on-blue incident is to try and stop the incident. It is never, ever, ever to identify a target and shoot back and try and kill your own guys. So had a case like that occurred, it would have involved in the F-16 pilot would have been subject to a court-martial. And so none of this happened. So all the rumors about an F-16 CJ shooting at a Patriot to shortstop a friendly fire incident didn't happen. More importantly, the SAM always have, you cannot outshoot a SAM even with a harm. SAM gets first launch. You're not going to save anybody with a harm shot. You may avenge somebody and you may get a harm in the air and force them to shut down, but dueling missiles, the SAM usually has the advantage. So there is no way that this story holds together and it needs to be thumped like a baby seal.
Okay. We'll go to one then from the live chat. This is the first one that came in, actually. And I'm sorry, I don't see the name of the person who did it. But your thoughts, this is interesting and very topical, but your thoughts on brain cancer. I have meningioma, Two of my pilots have died from glioblastoma. I'm sorry if I'm getting the pronunciation wrong.
Yep.
But not just our Trons, but all the folks training with fire control radars, Check 6.
Yeah, so that's a worry. Skip Jacoby, one of the guys I flew with, also died of brain cancer very young, a couple of years back. And I know of a couple of aviators who have also succumbed. So my thoughts are that the Department of Defense is only starting to do a job in assessing these. So the first survey was done, and it was very limited. It was limited to in-service guys and looking at cancer rates. And this was pushed by Vince Alcazar, the Red River Valley Fighter Pilots Association, call sign Aztec, Strike Eagle guy, good dude, really smart guy. Aztec basically pushed the study with some help from the Skunk Works in the Pentagon. And we as aviators seem to have a higher incidence of cancer, but it is also our maintenance and potentially our fuels guys as well. So it's clear that fighter aviators have some kind of additional exposure. Could be radars, could be cosmic rays, could be fuel and other toxic substances. And the Air Force is not good on the toxic exposure front. The DOD is not good. And that's why we have the burn pit problems. So there will be a second study, which will include previous fighter aviators and other aviators and our ground crew and our maintenance and support to try and see if trends can be identified. But it's a worry, but we don't have enough data to know what the causal factors are.
Is there a correlation between what's happening with US aviators and other aviators around the world? Are there other studies that you're aware of to increase the sort of data size, size of the data set?
I'm not aware of any studies. There's anecdotal evidence, which is exactly that, anecdotal evidence. I think after this first study, it would not surprise me to see NATO air forces starting to pick up studies of their own. But some small NATO air forces may not have a big enough sample size for it to matter. You know, the Royal Air Force, you get a big enough sample size. You know, Denmark, Holland, Portugal, maybe you don't have a big enough sample size. But if you aggregate it, it would be helpful in all cases.
Okay, well, good luck to you anyway. I'm sorry I didn't get your name. I think that was the first question that came through on the aborted live stream, so sorry about that, and I hope you managed to join this one and hear Starbaby's response. Anyway, another one then from the live stream from Nick Forster. How did you guys integrate with the F-15C guys? So he's talking about you when you were on the E-model. Says he was a Tornado GR4 guy when the F-3 guys joined. We were pure out of ground, but did a bit of BFM and much more ACT and affiliation. So we had a lot of role-specific stuff to adjust to. Their culture was different, and they had to adjust to no SA from Link 16 or a Pulse Doppler radar to what they could glean from AWACS commentary. Interesting.
So we tended to fly as different squadrons, but at Lake and Heath, we had the C-model squadron. We had the Reapers, right? So we did do ACT against them. I never flew BFM or ACM against a light gray. Part of the challenge was that they wouldn't show us their tapes. And at the time, for good reason. But we did do things occasionally, but we were not, I would say it was like, it was not much different from the next base over, even though the guys were in the same squadron. The two communities, the Strike Eagle community and the Eagle community, we ended up getting more Eagle pilots into the Strike Eagle community. And so those guys helped us refine our air-to-air game. So there was, I think, more integration at the, you get a pilot in your squadron level than there was between the squadrons.
Okay, so a question from the Discord. I like this one. From Potato, can you read an interstate highway sign from a comfortable altitude and speed in a fast jet enough to navigate by road sign?
I have never tried it. In a slow-moving aircraft, I have definitely dropped down low enough to read signs. Not because we needed to navigate by them, but because we wanted to know what they said. So, I mean, you see a big sign on the side of an island, you get curious. It's like, oh, what does that say? So I would not necessarily, if you have to read road signs in a fast jet, you probably have some kind of system problem where you actually want a lot of distance between you and the ground, and road signs are not your first choice of navigational aid.
Okay, here's another one from the Discord then. So, with the introduction of the Block 70 F-16, this is from Skip. The Block 70 F-16, has it finally earned your approval? Oh, he's on the spot.
No, just on general principles.
Okay. All right. Okay, let's look at the live chat. So Paco's asked, will Starbaby fly for a Ukraine private contractor? Would you do that?
Do they have strike eagles? Are they going to get strike eagles? I'm 56 years old, man. My fast moving, hair on fire, no risk assessment, all balls, dick, and no forehead. That phase is, I hope, behind me.
Oh, that's another one for a
Afraid the
t-shirt,
answer is
isn't
no.
it? All balls,
The
dick,
second
no.
question, though, the follow-on question is, what are the bennies and how much are they paying?
Okay, so Biggles Tintin had asked whether or not thousands of obsolete aircraft could be used as a swarm attack on Western aircraft to really deplete defenses. I guess that's kind of a valid thing. I suppose sort of China would have a bunch of old MiG-21s, MiG-19s. I don't know. They would probably throw hundreds of aircraft up in the air to act as sponges for AMRAAMs, deplete any sort of frontline defense or frontline attack capability, and maybe pave the way for follow-up aircraft that were more capable. Is that a valid tactic? Could you do that with drones?
So the Chinese have, and they've already, this is open source. I mean, they've told us they've done this. They've converted at least two wings of old jet airplanes to UAVs. I mean, really, the US does it too, right? We've got the QF-106s, the QF-100s. These are all fighter aircraft converted to target drones. The best of the bunch, of course, being the QF-16. And, well, I mean, realistically, because it was already fly-by-wire, right? So it was an easy conversion. So the airplane was practically built to be an unmanned target drone. So there's a point in its favor. And the all I have to say about that idea is nobody's tried it, and a kill's a kill.
Okay. All right. Another one then. Can you comment on the seemingly independence of the Flanker series from aerial tanker support? So that's from Erne Marines. I apologize. We're going to go back and forth from Ukraine to other topics here. I can't be bothered to try and stratify all the questions into Ukraine and non-Ukraine. I'm too tired to do any of that. So you just have to put up with me sort of rickrolling you on the questions. But have they got tanker support out there? The flankers flying with tanker support? Do they need it from the Russian point of view? If they're flying out of Belarus?
So, if you don't have tanker support, you have short sortie duration. Most of the Chinese and Russian tanker support was designed for the bombers. That isn't to say the fighters couldn't necessarily do it. But that's something whether or not they're doing it to support the caps, I haven't even looked at that to see if there are any OSINT trickles that tell us one way or the other. But if you're tanker independent is not a bonus. And nobody kicks ass without tanker gas. And so if you don't have a tanker available, you're flying a short sortie.
Here's a question I like on many levels, but Gareth Robert says, you guys are always entertaining. Thank you, Gareth. I'll take that compliment.
Is that a question? Was that an are you guys always entertaining?
That was the
We certainly
sweetener.
hope
That
so.
was the sweetener. Here comes the ask. Any Starbaby can I think he's saying, can Starbaby critique any 10% true DCS F-15E teaser videos? So,
No, of course not.
let's get this out of the way, because people are asking all over the place about you and DCS. What is your aversion to it? Why are you refusing to engage with the idea of maybe picking up that F15E module in DCS and flying around with it and offering a view on whether or not at an unclassified level it's a good representation of what the Strike Eagle is all about.
Yeah, so several reasons. Number one, I'm a Mac user. Okay, two, I've seen DCS guys set up their, you know, their setups with their throttles and their pedals and their multiple displays. I don't have the time, the inclination, or the money to do that. Thirdly, it's not my job to teach you how to fly an artificial airplane for free. And four, what if I suck? What if I suck at it? And I've just exhibited to the whole world I suck at DCS. Now, that probably won't damage my ego because it's pretty damage resistant and admittedly large. But why would I do that? You want to know how to fly the Strike Eagle? Watch my freaking tapes. Next question.
Okay. I see a chink of light in that answer. That's what I see. I'm just going to keep wearing you down on it. Okay, let's move on. All right.
It's the which part of no wasn't clear.
I didn't hear no. I heard I got four things I don't like. That's all I heard. No, okay. All right. So can you, we're going to go with the live chat again. So Carol Boissonnois, I think, is saying, is Russia's doing many things wrong to win gain ground. Are they doing some things right, in your opinion?
Yeah, but if I'm not going to tell you what they are.
Okay. Well, that was quick.
Sorry.
That's fair enough. Yeah, that's fair enough. I mean, I think, yeah. Okay, from the Discord then, Stuart B. has a hypothetical. Astonishing everyone, except maybe yourself. You've suddenly been elected President of the United States and Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. Can you outline your top five directives needed to reorganize and rebuild the U.S. Air Force?
So just so you know, when I graduated from my ROTC detachment at Penn State, was commissioned a second lieutenant, we had a bunch of awards and I picked up two. The first was most likely to become president. The second, of course, was most likely to be court-martialed. So I got that going for me. But at least I did not get most likely to be shot by your own men, which was a category. Okay, top five things. Aspirational bullshit in your concept development is out. Okay? If you can't write a concept of operations that explains in the real world what you want to do and how you want to do it, I'm not interested in your system or your plan. Okay, we do too much aspirational stuff where it's never going to work, where we're going to do away with the fog of war, or where we're going to have assured communications, done. Secondly, on as far as general officers go, we're going to tighten down on general officer discipline. And most general officers are just stand-up guys, but we've had a number of bad cases, including the Air Warfare Center commander, including a former MAGCOM commander. I mean, we're going to tighten down on the different spanks for different ranks. That would end. The third thing is, we're going to reinvest in training our people, and that's across the board. More flying hours in real airplanes and not simulators, and we're going to pay the money for those spares and for those flying hours. And the goal is going to be like it used to be, 250 to 300 hours per aircrew, per airplane, period. And if you've bought the airplane and it can't support that kind of rate, then that airplane needs to be inventoried out. Four, we're going to relook at electronic warfare, stealth, and the weasels, and how they're going to patch together. We're not going to deal with this kind of faith-based assessment on whether or not your stuff works against radars. We know what works against radars, and we moved off the home base there into theoretical, you know, should work against radars, or it used to work, you know, in limited conditions. And we need to look at our stealth and our non-stealth balance, and range and payload still matter. And lastly, and this is not really an Air Force purview, because we're very much constrained by funding and regulations, but we have to recommit to innovation and we have to be real about it. And that means that the Air Force tendency to suppress dissent and things that are outside the box, except in the smallest and most insignificant of cases, we need to work our way out of that. And we do that through professional military education and through our force development. and it'll take time. We need to break that cultural boundary. There, five.
Win. Okay. So back to the live stream. So Shari, hey Shari, has asked a question. I think you kind of already answered it, but she says that the US transitioned to the F4 during the Vietnam War, and how would that experience equate to the Ukrainian experience with trying to obtain aircraft? We have obviously already covered off the F-16 or other type piece already, but any brief thoughts on that?
Yeah, so we lost a lot of guys and a lot of Phantoms in Vietnam, and I think that no matter how you do it, a transition to a new aircraft in wartime is going to be a bit challenging. And there are a lot of things we had to discover about the Phantom, from, you know, how sucky it is to procure an aircraft without a gun, to what the failure rate of the AIM-7 missile is, to how totally and amazingly important it is to have a navigator in the backseat instead of a pilot who doesn't want to be there. There's a lot of lessons to be learned, and it's always going to be tough. And there are no easy answers to a transition. So I think that's the answer, is the lessons from the F4 is to realize that it's going to be very, very hard to do right, and you need to pay attention. And it would have been easier if certain things that looked obvious in hindsight could have been thought out ahead of time. So no aspirational bullshit.
Here's a really interesting question that sort of turns the whole thing on its head, really, from Matthew Gonzalez. He's asking that apparently the Ukraine news from today announced that the Ukrainian Air Force has said that it will allow foreigners to serve as pilots. I don't know if that's true or if that's just a hypothetical, but how would that work the other way around then? So you've got people who are used to a very different doctrine, a different set of tactics, techniques, procedures, different technologies, and you go and stick them in a flanker or a MiG-29. Would they succeed?
Why would they have to be non-flanker, non-MiG-29 guys? They are Polish, German, Czech, Moldovan, you know, other Ukrainian, Georgian. There are MiG-29 and Fulcrum pilots out there.
Yeah, but let's say that Ukraine has a pool from which to choose, and that's not to be disparaging to those people. But do you think there would be a propensity for them to look to Western pilots to fill those slots? Because the seat of the pant flying thing is easy, right? It's, you know, what's difficult is the employment, the execution, it's the tactics, it's the debriefing, it's the learning.
So remember that Ukraine did that in terms of accepting foreign fighters and enlisting them in the Ukrainian military. And when you look at all the masses that started coming in March of last year, a year ago, you'll find that, and I just read this, 80 to 90% of those people are dead or have gone home. Okay. You cannot afford to do that with aircraft. You cannot afford to have a 10-to-1 ratio. And unless you're accepting previously qualified MiG or Sukhoi pilots, that's what you're going to get.
Did you ever hear about that former Air Force maintainer who was flying Mirages in the Libyan? And it wasn't the Libyan Air Force. It was obviously some kind of, you know, faction of the Libyan Air Force. Did you hear about that guy?
No, but you know that essentially Royal Air Force guys have flown for the Omanis or the Bahrainis or any number of Persian Gulf nations for quite some time.
Yeah. But that's an official thing. That's where we send them over, and it's officially sanctioned. This was an Air Force maintainer. He wasn't a fast jet pilot. He was just somebody who wanted to fly jets. Anyway, kudos to him. He wanted to fly
good
jets,
on it,
and
man.
So that's what he did. All right. How much time have we got? Where are we at time-wise? I think we'll be...
I got all night.
You got all night? I don't. I've got, let's say, another 10, 15 minutes. Is that okay?
It's okay.
We'll try and work through as many questions as we can. So back to the Discord questions. And I'm going to try and pick ones that we haven't already kind of touched. So if you asked your question, like this question here about the MiG-29s from Poland, which we've kind of already touched on. So Weasel asked your opinion on secure data link voice radios. So as far as...
Yeah, I remember that question. The Air Force's secure voice is terrible. It's KY-58, which is a replacement for KY-28, which was compromised during the Vietnam War. It's terrible. It's tactically useless. And the Air Force communications architecture, the communications are A6. They're still kind of, I think, behind the other services on this. We did not invest in Link 16 voice, JVoice, although the Navy did. So we have a bunch of Navy guys who can talk to each other on Link 16. We've got the same Link 16, but we don't have JVoice. And the Army has like the SINGARs radio, which have absolutely seamless secure radio. You wouldn't know it's secure unless you see it on the that little secure thing come up on the handheld on the display. So we could do better. We haven't done better, and someday we'll need to do better. We end up using Havquick as a de facto system for avoiding intercept, and it appears to be not bad at that because it can be reconstructed, but by the time it's reconstructed, the event at which you're talking about is long since gone. I will say, however, that all the guys shooting down balloons over the continental US should have been on Havquick so that hobbyists weren't listening to and recording their comm.
Why do you think they weren't? Why do you think? What do you think prevented them doing that?
A, they didn't think of it. Or B, like many squadrons, they don't know how to use Havquick because they don't use it every day. You've seen this rant before.
I think you and Shari are both talking about that as a Strike Eagle thing. Okay. So here's a sort of follow-on then. Well, it's a follow-on from Weasel, who's asked a few questions, I think. But do you think a HARM-capable EF-111 with some of the F4G's EW suite would have been a good idea?
They didn't need the F4G's EW suite. Sherry points out that the HARM modification was already in funding and in progress, but it was only done to one or two aircraft. And then it was terminated in order to save money. So it would, there was, you weren't going to rebuild an EF-111 with an APR-47 in it. The APR-47 was 52 antennas and 25 black boxes. We had to pull the gun in the ammo bay in order to put that in. So you just don't have all that room in the EF-111. You'd have used the ALQ-99 and added a HARM capability, and you'd have gotten a pretty decent HARM capability, at least as good as what the Prowler had at the time.
Okay, sticking on the subject of HARMs then, did the Strike Eagle ever carry the HARM? And that's a question from Mike.
Only the test birds at Eglin, and it was just a captive carry test on stations 1 or 9. The Strike Eagle's electronic warfare systems were not a good match for HARM. It would have been just shooting stupid HARMs like a Block 30 F-16, no better than that. And that potential, though, with the F-15EX or modified F-15s with a new electronic warfare system, that with EPAWS, that is something that should logically be explored. But that's when you'll know that the Air Force is serious about defense suppression again. So when you see the EX or upgraded E's carrying HARMs.
Okay, so I mean, there were actually a couple of questions on that, so we'll move over those. So Avwriter Joe asked, have you ever dropped a JDAM?
I've never dropped a JDAM.
Never fired a HARM either, did you?
Nope.
Crazy.
I've dropped 100,000 pounds of weapons in combat, and not one of them was a JDAM or a HARM.
Okay, so Alfredo asks, what's your favorite mission to fly, or type of mission to fly, and what was your weapon of choice for DIAD?
Ah. So I was not an AGM-130 guy. Okay, but that would be my weapon of choice for destruction of enemy air defenses. However, my favorite mission to fly really was a defense suppression mission in the F4G.
For what reason? Expand on that
Yeah,
so
of
I can
course.
pick another question.
What?
Expand on that so I can pick another question from the live chat.
Yeah, so I mean, the F4 sensor suite was awesome. The capabilities were great, the situational awareness was good. The mission was good. We had an experienced squadron. And so I really liked flying those missions. And I knew the system really well. I knew how the system was programmed. And literally, the later software, I got to be the operational rep for the last two software designs. Really, most especially for the Tape 9000. And Tape 9000 was designed to do things that I wanted to do with the system. So,
Tape
really, it's
9000 was
been.
the OFP tape?
Yeah, OFP 9000.
9000 presumably wasn't the sort of sequential number, was it?
No, it went from 7,000 to 8,000 to 9,000. So actually, it was the sequential number, but we took it in big bites.
Okay. So Gashpul, I think, is the pronunciation. Hello, was the AGM 130 and the F-15 you used against SAM systems or usually on fixed targets? You have kind of, in a roundabout way, answered that question in some of the other videos. So, Gashpul, I would recommend going and watching, like, the Mosul SA-3 strike video. Then there's some Balkans videos that Starbaby recorded where, actually, was did you
The
talk about AGM 130 in those?
Wild Weasel
Yeah.
Part 3 is where I talk most about the AGM-130 and show the videos. So yes, it was used for both fixed targets and SAM targets that were not moving.
So Gonzo has asked about whether or not you've had a chance to look around an F-15EX yet.
No, I mean, I've talked to guys that have flown it and I've gotten some neat tidbits around, but I haven't had the chance to look around it. And certainly not, I mean, it would have to be power on. The place for me to look at it would be to really play with it in a simulator.
Is
And no,
it?
I haven't done that.
So the Air National Guard's flying them, and they're flying them single seat. Does that sort of jar at all?
Yeah, that's like one of the dumbest things ever. So the biggest, baddest Strike Eagles to ever roll off the production line. An enormously capable fighter with brand new, essentially fifth generation or five gen plus avionics, and it's going to fly continental air defense for the Air Guard with one dude in it. Get real. But the reason that was done is because that way they could get the money to do it, because it is the official replacement for the F-15C model, which was also wasted in continental air defense. Really, I mean, what have we shot down in continental air defense in the entire history of the mission? A couple of balloons. Ooh.
You've escorted a lot of bears and badgers and bisons and other things beginning with B.
Yeah, so a lot of the bears and badgers, I mean, the Black Knights out of Iceland used to intercept them. They were in Iceland. Guys in Alaska, not continental United States, you know, guys in Alaska are intercepting. How often did the guys in Florida at Homestead intercept bears? Actually, fairly often, because they were flying one way to Cuba.
Yeah.
Out in the Oregon Guard, please.
So here's an interesting. It's interesting because I don't know how or whether or not you're going to be able to answer it. But LB69er was asking around. This is a hypothetical question, so just go with the flow. You may have already read this, you may not have. But it's around this idea that if somebody were assigned to fly an ultra secret SR-72 type airplane, or they were read into that kind of program, how much would they be educated about it? And sort of this individual, I guess, is just trying to understand how compartmentalization works. I don't know if it's something you can, in a very broad and non-specific way, answer that question. If you were read into a black program, would you get all the skinny on it, or would they only give you the bits you need to know to do your job?
You'd get most of the skinny about it. And I suspect that trends towards all the skinny. And we already have examples of that. We have Constant Peg. Okay, the guy's got the technical manuals. They got everything, you know, they got translations. The 117. 117, a very secretive program. And those guys had to maintain the flight knowledge not only on the 117, but on the aircraft that was their cover story, which is not unusual, by the way, from 117 guys also flying T-38s. Or SR-71 guys also flying T-38s in order to keep their hours up. So yeah, we can't afford to have to put aircrew in a situation where we didn't tell them enough about the airplane.
Okay, so last few questions then. So Single Sprocket had asked in the live chat, it's an interesting question. I don't think we discussed it because I don't think it happened at the time. But there was, at the end of last year, this incident where a Su-27 fired a missile that went past an RAF rivet joint. And I understand it was untargeted. And I think it's, at least in the general public, the sort of sound bites coming out of the British MOD were that it was an accident. They didn't think it had been done deliberately. But what's your take on that incident? Did you have any thoughts about it? What does it say about, I don't know, we kind of already covered it a little bit. You talked about the Soviets shooting down reconnaissance aircraft in international waters. Is that a harbinger of things to come?
I've been around mishaps where weapons were inadvertently fired. When I was in FTU, the gun was inadvertently fired during a weapons check. But it wasn't actually fired because the master arm was still safe. So the gun was spun, which means it pretty well broke up, shell parts all over the nose bay, which was not noticed until I pre-flighted the aircraft for the next flight, opened the bay, and it's full of gunpowder and broken shell casings. I step away from the airplane, tell the ground crew to step away from the airplane, and, you know, said, well, we're stepping to a spare, and this is somebody else's problem. But again, also in Allied force, I was, you know, Ugg and I, our wingman, inadvertently fires an AIM-9. So inadvertent firing, it happens, you know, switches in the wrong position. You hit the button at the wrong time for the wrong reason. I wouldn't read anything into it.
Okay. By the way, I don't know if we actually taped the outcome of that story. So that story is in one of the other videos that we've already released about, so the inadvertent AIM-9 firing. Was it you who told me or somebody else told me about the pilot in question when they landed? Also, was it in the Wizzo said, did you just fire an AIM-9? And the guy in the front went, fuck yeah. And then for a sort of week or so after that, the answer to every question in the squadron was, fuck yeah.
Yeah, that's all true. It was just, I mean, there are weird things that happen in the squadron, right? I mean, there was, and this may be judges' fault, but for years at the 494th Fighter Squadron, somebody would ask a question, you know, where is something? And the other person would reply, if it were up your ass, you'd know where it was. I blame Judge, even if it's not actually his fault. But nevertheless, these kind of this is exactly the kind of event that gets something into your vernacular. So okay. It is, man.
I'm going to have to use that. That's brilliant. Okay. All right. And here's another one, actually. This is coincidental, but another one from Single Sprocket, but it's from the Discord server. And I know you kind of already answered part of this, but I'm going to ask anyway, because it'd be interesting to see what your response is in person. But what's the most tragic event that was avoidable that you've witnessed in the Air Force? And what's the most funniest?
The funniest that I can recall has really got to be the supersonic sausage patty laydowns. I would be hard pressed to think of anything that was just more off the wall, kind of funny, glad you did it. The story is never going to get old than that kind of event. Supersonic sausage patty laydowns has got to take the cake.
And what about the first part then? So you don't have to, obviously you don't have to, you're not here under duress. You don't have to answer any of these questions, but if you don't want to answer the question, can you talk a little then around, I don't want to sound cliched and, you know, but around mental health and, you know, if you've seen something happen that's bad, that was avoidable and it still affects you. You know, and you've already talked about the issue with bombing the village, you know, being asked to go and bomb that village and you feel bad because you dumped the bombs in a forest thinking that was a good alternative, you know. So there are obviously things that happen to you in your Air Force career that continue to be in your mind. But how do you deal with those sorts of things if they are there in your dreams?
Oh, well, you know, so everybody deals with that a little bit differently, right? If you're going to be involved in aviation, there's going to be tragedy. And some of it's just going to be unavoidable stuff, like an ejection seat fired because of a short circuit, because one cable was an inch longer than it should have been. You know, that is hard to get your ring around, but you don't see how you could have avoided it. It was just this ridiculous chain of accidents. And there's other things where if a guy had pulled the handle 1/10 of a second earlier, you know, both crew members would have survived the ejection. That's all going to happen in aviation. And you don't really ever get used to it, but each individual comes up with their own method of dealing with it. And not all methods are perfect. I mean, what do I have the most bad dreams about? High school. That's number one. Okay. High school is number one, as if I have to go back through high school. I mean, I'm a retired colonel. I have a master's degree and they're making me go through high school again. That's a recurring nightmare. The other is going back into college and having semesters of failing transcripts because I never show up because I can't find my schedule because I blow the class off. And it was a stupid subject to take anyway. That's a recurring nightmare. But I didn't fail classes in college. I attended most of them. Yes, I blew off entirely too many classes, but I got through with the GPA I needed to have. I think I graduated at 3.05. And I'm even made Dean's List a couple of times, which must have been a ridiculous accident. And then the third is misplacing or not being able to account for my sidearm or my rifle. And I've never misplaced or been unable to account for my sidearm or my rifle. I did have a deathly feel of dropping my sidearm in a porta potty and having to fish it out again. And so, oh yeah, boy, that was, I mean, if you ever double secure your hardware, it's going to the bathroom because the last thing you want to do is drop your sidearm in a porta potty. Yep. Well, anyway, so one of the ways you make jokes about things you have the dreams about and you move on.
Okay, we'll do final question then, and then so Star Baby has, for anybody who's not aware of this, Star Baby has a penchant for taking all the questions that people ask that didn't get asked in the live stream, and if he has time, going into the Discord and answering them, which is frankly a ridiculously good thing to do. So if you didn't get your question asked, then don't be downhearted. There's a possibility I'll dump them into a text file. There's a possibility that Star Baby will get to them at some point and put them into the Discord.
So there's an unanswered questions thread, which you just reactivate, dump the questions in. I will get around to answering them unless I defer them to a later podcast. So light attack stuff, rifle carrying stuff, wild weasel stuff, that's all going to be deferred to a later podcast.
Okay, so the final question is from Safe on Deck Podcast. Hello. So he asks, what are your thoughts on the Navy essentially passing responsibility for the FACA mission to the Marines?
Yeah, why not? So, my thoughts are twofold. One is that indicates that Navy pilots aren't getting enough hours. If you're divesting yourself of a mission like FAC-A, which is a training intensive mission, that means you're not giving your air crew enough hours. And if you were flying them at 250 hours a year, like you should be, it would not be a question. But realistically, sometimes when you are forced in a lower number of flying hours, you have to decide what you need to be good at the moment. And in the case of the Navy, they can probably afford to give up FAC-A and let the Marines handle it in the expectation that if they need FAC-A again, they still have a cadre of Marine aviators who can teach it to them again. So I think it's a bad indication for the Navy, but it is a reasonable solution to not enough fighter hours to handle all your missions.
Okay. On which note, we will draw this to a close. So, Star Baby, thank you so much once again for your time and for the insight and entertainment that you've provided with us this evening. To everybody at home, thanks for tuning in. Feel free to like, subscribe, and if you thought this was good, share it. Star Baby, we will see you again then. Well, everyone here is going to see you again because I'm sure they're going to tune in for the pre-recorded AMA in about a week's time. That's when that will go up. And then they will see you live again in about 3 weeks' time or 4 weeks' time or so, because that will be the end of April. And that's when we're going to go with the final installation of the Wild Weasel month. So thanks once again. And
Yeah,
to
that's a
everybody at
great
home.
idea. We should have a Wild Weasel month every year just on general principles. Month of the Wild Weasel. We'll even let those mild weasel guys participate.
Oh, we will. Okay, fantastic.
I'm feeling generous. I mean,
Do
it's a whole month, right?
you
Maybe
think
we
they'll
could have a
show?
mild weasel week within the Wild Weasel month. That would be acceptable.
Okay, and thanks also to all the moderators. Thanks to everybody who works on the Discord side of things to make things happen. And I look forward to seeing everybody again soon. Have a great weekend. We're done.
Yes, and our mild weasel week should.